Holly, great to see you here at Hamilton Road Baptist. Just tell us where you've come from, who you've left at home, and just a little bit about yourself.
Well, the first thing I have to just tell you, I'm from Omagh, right? And see that song, Before the Throne of God? The lady who wrote that, Charity Lee Bancroft, Lee's Bancroft, her father was the rector of my home church in Omagh in 1869. So thank you for picking that song.
No problem.
That was very well. You've done a great job, because not many people would know that.
Yes.
But yes, I'm Paddy Quinn. I'm married to Wendy, and she's 36 and a half years or so. And four children, Tara, Jordan, Hannah, and Christopher. Two grandchildren, Charlotte and Samuel. I'm a firefighter by trade currently, and currently working at Lisburn.
Brilliant. So let's go back to growing up. What was life like growing up in Omagh? Your background and all that.
Oh, yeah. For me, I was brought up in the Sacred Heart Chapel in Omagh, so brought up Catholic faith, and done all the things you do: baptized, confirmed, Holy Communion, and a first confession. And in all that time, I mean, I knew something about God. I knew of him, but not personally didn't know him. It's like somebody telling you about some famous footballer, but he's not actually your friend. But you know you've heard of Messi, and you know he's a good footballer, but he's not actually your friend. But you, so in that sense. But I used to go to Mass a lot, even when I was young. I went. I had a great sense of wanting to go to Mass. I felt drawn to it, but not, trying to work my faith. So it's a lot different than it is now. And in that time, my main desire was sport. And in that sport, I would have played any sport that you would have given me, but mainly Gaelic football. Probably because Gaelic football, if you have a lot of spirit, as a one for being aggressive maybe, really is a good sport for you to play. And that's the sport I was brought up playing.
So tell us about playing GAA from a child and going through all the different teams and all the different competitions.
Well, you know, Omagh was a town that people got on well with. You know, basically everybody got on well. So you didn't necessarily know who was who. You just went about playing your sport. So I grew up playing sport. I was determined I would play for Tyrone someday. And I thought if I played for Tyrone once, put on the senior shirt once, I would die happy. And it's amazing what you think sometimes. And actually, when I did, I always think it's funny, the day I did get called up and we went for the first match, it was a friendly, and I turned up, took it that seriously, and I turned up in a shirt and tie, suit, and everybody was dressed less casual than I am now. But I grew up, and that's what I wanted to do. I used to pray to win football matches, and the only prayer I used to know was saying set prayers, Our Father, Hail Marys. I didn't know that I could talk to God the Father and ask for wee things, because I eventually stopped praying because I thought, well, I would need to train harder to do that, you know. So, but that was all ever was my desire, was to play Gaelic football as high a level as and as often as I could. But I said I played for Omagh Town soccer as well, and like when I was like 17, I was the reserve player of the year. I'd already by 16 played B division, and.
So you're a sports crazy growing up.
Oh.
How did that go down with your GCSEs or your O levels back then, maybe? And I don't want to say anything, but you know, were you able to do both hand in hand, or?
Well, I'd like to say it is, because there's young people here, but don't follow my example. I played that much sport, running, table tennis, soccer, Gaelic, anything you let me at, that the first go of doing O-levels, and there were O-levels, I didn't get any of them. It's the only person I know ever, I don't ever heard anybody else ever feel them all before. So it's like, hey, it happened, that's the way it is. And life's turned out really good, so I obviously learned a lot from that.
Yeah.
But that actually, God maybe has a plan on this, because when I feel them all, what could you do? You're 16, going on 17 years of age. What do? You don't know anything. And I went to technical college and I tried an engineering thing and I hadn't the first clue about that. So it lasted 4 days.
Right.
So I said, oh, I'll just go back and do O levels again, one more go. Now, I did get two the second time round. But the day I walked into that classroom, that new classroom, I met my wife, Wendy. Well, I didn't probably meet her that day. And I think because of my football and stuff, she thought I was arrogant. But she became my first girlfriend, and I became her first boyfriend. And that was 1979, and we're still together now.
Very good. What is your secret to staying together so long?
I was fairly poor at it. You know, sometimes you grow up and you have a standard, and my standard was low, and I set it. It was only when I was trying to be better than somebody who I won't name, but wouldn't be right. And I'm not criticizing, but I thought I was being a good father until, or a good husband, until I watched the film Fireproof with a load of firefighters and their wives. And one of the wives said, "Does anyone know a hanky at the end of it?" And I says, "I do." And she was joking, but I seriously was crying because I really realized I was so short of being what a husband should be. But secret, I don't know, God has hand on that because he's kept us together, because there's times that life was a challenge. Because, I mean, that sounds a little romantic, but in Northern Ireland, it actually wasn't romantic, because if you ever look in Omagh, you'll see two churches at the top of the hill, and one's the Catholic Church and one's the Church of Ireland. And of course, Wendy's went to the Church of Ireland, and they're only like 40 meters apart, and I went to the Catholic. And as I sometimes say, it's, you know, people, I have friends who say, "Oh, I have Protestants are good friends, I have Catholics are good friends." And but when you take one home, all of a sudden you do test your families. In 1979, we found that out. There was one time Wendy said she was going up to watch me at the Gaelic pitch, which is up more or less behind our house, and her father was up fixing the roof. He says, "Where are you going?" "I'm going to watch up to the Gaelic pitch." He jumped off the roof. "You're going where?" And then you see my name gives it away. Paddy Quinn. And then I lived in the Derry Road, and almost like living, say, in the Falls Road, and called Paddy Quinn. You sort of like, they knew straight away, oh, he knows the trouble. So it didn't go down that well. So we ended up going to England for a few years.
Okay. So she took you away from the GAA for?
I know. I really don't know how that was done. Because every year, every day for 4 years, I thought, all I really thought about was playing Gaelic football again. And all that time, and that's what really brought us home, because I couldn't do without it anymore. And I know that's maybe a selfish thing, but it's true. But in that time, our daughter, we got married, and our daughter Tara was born. And here's the thing, you know, I knew she had to be baptized, but I didn't. So which church? You know? And who do you offend the most? And so Wendy told me, "Well, the Church of Ireland's nearly the same as the Catholics."
No comment.
Oh, I can talk. You see, I joke up. It's nothing serious, you know, because churches are churches, and I've been to many. And to be honest, I never heard the gospel in any of them. I may have got it, might have been spoken about, but I never heard it. And I reckon I've probably heard 12,000 sermons, at least, the very least, and I never heard what I believe the gospel wants, or I never filtered in through this. Well, put it like this, if you fail all your old levels, I'm probably not the sharpest. But she said to me, it's nearly the same, so I decided that I would get Tara, because I knew it was important, but I didn't know God, how important he was. So I decided, well, I could live with the Church of Ireland. And actually, because, well, you know how stubborn Protestants are? Never, never, never.
I've heard somebody say that before.
Funny enough, I heard that too, and I think it might have been Wendy. There was no way. And that's joking. She really, it was my choice. I decided, because, you know, I didn't really get it how you go to two different churches. How you would brought up one religion and then another. Because I would have been, we would have been up to say 10 o'clock, so I'd have gone to 10 o'clock mass, dropped them off at Sunday school, Wendy would have been there, and I'd be, I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. It really doesn't. So I decided God was in both of those churches. Even though I didn't know him personally. And that's how we did. And then I spent years, you know, I went from a church across the street with all my family, with all my friends, all my Gaelic football friends, my whole life, where I used to go, even at 11-year-old, I used to do Lent, 40 days and 40 nights, and become a Christian, you find out it's actually more than that. So I'd done it for about 46. I sent it 11 years on my own free will, 8 o'clock in the morning before school. That's the type of faith I had. When I went to England, Wendy used to go with me. I used to find a chapel and I used to go to Mass because of what I believed. So, but no, I started going. And then in the Church of England or Ireland, I think not many people spoke to me. Unless you were called Jackie. Most Jackies spoke to me. After that, nobody else spoke to me for some reason. So I spent many years, 20 plus years in there, and with very little friends.
Right. So all during this period, you still don't have a saving faith in Christ. You still don't. It's just routine, it's habit, it's your upbringing, and you're just carrying that on. Tell us about you and your work life as well. When did you join the fire service, and tell us just a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I just got on, and church was church, and church was something you done, and church was religion. Church was something you done that you'd hope with the hope of getting to heaven. And I had this thing of, and then just because I'm deviating a wee bit away from it, just to clarify, I had this thing: you need to work to get into heaven. Good works got you to heaven, and if you hit the crossbar, you might end up in purgatory. So I believed anyway, and I thought that's what it was all about. I thought that's how you get into heaven. God would choose the good people. I didn't think you'd, I didn't believe. I can't believe what I believe now, if you understand. Mm. So anyway, I worked away. And when I came home from England, I worked with my father for a while and had a carpet shop, and then I sort of took it over. And then a friend of mine came in one day, and he was a part-time firefighter, which is only across the street, and I never noticed it. And he used to do about 700-800 calls a year, but he says, why don't you join that? That'd be handy for you. You know, it'd be handy. You'd be able to just run out. And I thought, okay. So I signed up. And what he did, he just told me, he didn't tell me much about the aptitude test. He didn't tell me, for instance, how to climb a ladder, because I don't like heights. Because when I was about 17, my mum asked me to climb a ladder, clean a gutter. I mean, it's only a two-story house, and I got halfway and had to get my mate to do it. So anyway, I got it, and I didn't get in when he applied, but some boy decided a month later he wanted to go to Australia, so he resigned, and I got into the fire service on the strength of that, and through the back door. And I'd done that, worked away, loved it, served as a retained firefighter in town, and then in 2000 I get into the whole time as become a full-time firefighter, and I always believe God has a hand in this, because if you think I got in the first time, it was just by this time I know, as far as I know, I'm the only full-time firefighter who failed the first aptitude test and still in the job, and that's an eyesight test. I never failed an eyesight before, but I got it sorted anyway, and I'm in the job now 18 and a half years as a full-time firefighter.
So you joined the fire service in 95.
Yeah.
3 years later, lots of us are watching on television. There's a bomb going off in Oma. Tell us where you were that day and some of the things that you possibly just want to share.
I guess it's 20 years since it happened, and it's only this year I first talked about it openly. And I just say this to because people suffer a lot more than me. And sometimes as a firefighter, people will say to you, oh, you're doing a great job. Yeah, we are doing a great job, but people suffer a lot more than us. And that day, people suffered 1,000 times more than me. So it's just to put that straight. But that day, I started off, it was our son's birthday. On the Tuesday when they asked us to reflect on it, I couldn't even remember that until somebody told me the trauma of the day. So. Anyway, I was working away, and the next thing I heard this bang, and then I heard a window shattering. I went out the back of where I was working, and I faced up towards where I lived, towards the army barracks in Oma and the police barracks, and I thought, that must be the army barracks, but I better go up to the house. And so I run out of the shop in the car, and I only got about 30 meters, and my fire alerter went off. So I diverted to the station, which is only an hour 30 meters. And we run in, and there we go again. I got the printout, and it said, oh, bomb at the courthouse. So we thought, well, the courthouse is bombed. That's just one of those things. The way it's normal, like, you don't really think much of it. So we all go in, we've only about 500 meters, 600 meters to go. We all jumped in, turned right, then left at the lights. And I seen a scene that I've never, like, it's like something in a movie. You would see the way I set it up, the dust everywhere. I see all I could hear initially was women and children screaming. And when we were pulled up in the lorry, I had a breathing apparatus on. And I looked out, just no further than that seat away from me, I looked out and I see my mum sitting on the curb. And I jumped out and I said, "Are you all right?" And she said, "Yes, I am." And she asked, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm grand. Listen, I have to go and do work." And what I hadn't realized, she had walked in front of a car that had just, in front of the car that had was blown up. The car was blown up and there's another car in front of it. You still see it there now in the photographs. And she walked in front of that. And the bag she was carrying just were blown. All she had was the shreds of the plastic bag. But she's still alive, like, you know, how does that happen? And I remember during the troubles I used to, unless you're really affected anyway, can you really, really say, you know, we sometimes say, "Oh, I know how you feel." We really don't know. And but that day I often thought of, why do people not forgive? I heard them on the television and I heard people saying, "Oh, I can't forgive, I'll take it to my grave." Well, that day walking the street at one stage, I remember thinking, now I know why people can't forgive. I now know why people take it to the grave. And I wasn't even, so I was just in the midst of saying something so horrible. And it was so indiscriminate. It didn't matter which religion you were. It didn't matter which color you were. It didn't matter what age you were. Somebody just left a bomb and just ruined people's lives forever.
And then you're continuing on in the fire service, you're still going to church, you're still doing the Christian thing, but you're still aren't a Christian. Right. Tell us about then what happened about 10 years after the Uma bombing and you come into faith.
Well, I wouldn't call what I was doing was Christian, I would call it religion.
Right.
Because, you know, and I know there is a difference. But what happened was, in 2007, they phoned me up and said, "Do you want to take a temporary in Cookstown?" I said, "Oh, I can't. I wouldn't be able to take." I told them that couldn't be done, and they said, "You're right, it couldn't." And he says, "But how about the training center in Belfast?" Now, nobody from OMA ever volunteers to go on a temporary promotion to our training center, especially our training center. And I said, "No, I'll give it a go." And I went for 3 months and ended up being there a year. And then that year, I met some guys who I knew to be Christians, but Christians who I would have deemed to be with the term good living, Bible bashers. I mean, that's the term. When you come from OMA and you're brought up Catholic, that's the sort of thing that you would think. There's guys involved in Firefighters for Christ, which is a Christian ministry in the fire service. Once again, I thought that was a load of good living guys who I would never really associate with. So I went up there totally with a prejudiced view of these people. Now, in this group, in some of the group, there was a Presbyterian. There was a Free Presbyterian. There was a Elam Pentecostal. And a Baptist, and he was the worst.
Right there. You've got to watch those Baptists.
I never
remember. Somebody wearing water.
I know, I don't know. I noticed that I'm sitting on a tank here. I worked that out.
And I just hadn't told you, Pab, what's happened lately.
Well, I decided one time when I was asked, would it be interesting to get baptized? And I said, well, not in a tank. Jesus done it in open water. So I done it in East Strand off Port Rush. So I thought I was doing it right. 7 o'clock at night on a Sunday evening, singing Amazing Grace. You don't do anything better than that. So anyway, these guys, and I got friendly, and one of the ones I got friendly with most was actually William, who's a Free Presbyterian, an ex-soldier. I used to like giving out tracts. I still does, actually, because that's how he came to faith. And here's me, Paddy, Catholic Church, Gaelic footballer. I'd like, wouldn't touch a track of you. You know, I used to avoid the boys in the town. They'd be hearing the megaphones going, "You must be born again. If you're not, you're going to burn in hell," and all this. And I go, "Whoa, get the other side of the street quick." Because I didn't understand. I thought it was made up. I mean, I didn't know what I thought. Because I didn't know anything. Actually, up to this time, up to 2008, I never owned a Bible. I never read a Bible. I never encouraged to read the Bible. And I don't blame nobody for that at all, and I never will, because that's just my story. So anyway, I used to challenge these guys. And we used to sit around and say on an afternoon tea break. And I used to challenge Big Willie, because I always thought he was a Free Presbyterian. He was pushing the boundaries a wee bit further than I thought they should be pushed. But everything just was about legal. That sounds but he was a great encourager, you know, he never sort of like told me I was wrong. But here's me challenging these guys on the Bible. And I never read the Bible. I mean, that doesn't make any sense, does it? That's like telling somebody who builds a computer, telling them they're wrong about how they're doing it, because you don't never read the book. So one of the things I challenged them on was this one here, was Noah. I challenged them. I remember to this day sitting to them and saying to them, "Now, guys, come on, you're telling," because I used to think all these stories were parables or some sort of story just to make an example. So it didn't. And I said, guys, you telling me that he built an ark 135 meters long, 23 meters wide, and 14 meters. I mean, it's not as if like it was in Belfast and I had a heart and wolf. He went down and ordered it and said, hey, by the way, God just told me I want an ark this size and I want to build it these dimensions. And by the way, up to the zoo and says, I want two of every animal. I mean, sure, that's impossible. But now I know it's true, and I accept that. But what they went on to say, that the Baptist guy and the Pentecostal had an argument if it had actually rained at that stage. One was saying it hadn't rained, and the Baptist saying it had rained. So, but then he's like water, so it's, I mean, that would make sense. And he's like ducking it all the time. So, and he, but I thought, yeah, okay. And then he talked about the rainbow being God's covenant, that he would never flood the earth again. Now, I even say this to my family and Catholic friends, and they say, aye, that's right. I go, nobody told me that. So I said, I must have been doing a lot of sleep in the church. And I didn't get it, because I always thought the rainbow, I thought this thing, oh, sure, it's more like the leprechaun in a pot of gold. But yeah. I never knew. But when I heard that there, I went to look and find it out. And I don't know where I found it out. I don't, probably Google it or something, because I didn't have a Bible. But all that time, I don't know what specific it was. Someone was drawing me. I wanted, he used to take me up to Randallstown Free Presbyterian, because on a Sunday night, they used to give away food for friends and family. And when you say cream buns and a firefighter, he's there all day long. But seriously, it was a bit strange, but I used to go along, and I used to hear testimonies. And then the guys would tell me about God and share their faith. And I knew in their faith there was something there. And I knew I wanted it. I wanted to give my life to Christ. I would be places where it would be offered. And I couldn't do it because, you know why? I decided I need to make myself perfect. I need to get rid of all the sin, and then I give my life to Christ. And the 4th of December 2008, and a lot of stuff happened, you know, I mean, all the time. And I knew God was talking to me. You know, you can't explain this. You can't. It's hard to explain. It's just a draw that was never there before. But I just knew that this was, God's hand was on me. But I couldn't get there. So on the 4th of December 2008, Firefighters Christ had a carol service in their big hall, dining hall in the Boucher Road. And my friend Phil got up and he started talking about the word was with the word and the word became the word. And I'm thinking, what does he mean with this, all this word stuff? You know, yeah. I mean, that's like not long ago. But that's okay. He done his bit. And he came over to me in the middle of the hall and I'm standing there and he says, Paddy, do you want to pray? I says, you know, Phil, I don't know how to pray. I thought he was going to teach me how to talk to God, because I didn't know how to. You know, when you learn to pray now, I would just talk to God as if he was my friend. But what he meant was, do you want to pray the sinner's prayer and get it sorted out? He had decided that night that I wasn't leaving that place until I'd made that commitment. Now, he didn't know, I didn't know he knew that, I didn't know he was going to do that, but that's what his decision. He actually told me the other day, it was probably one of the most biggest things in his life. But that day, he just said, close your eyes. And I go red while easy. And I was like, I could feel my face red. And it was that red, embarrassed. I didn't actually know what I said. And it wasn't until I was going home in the car, my wife said to me, Wendy says, what were you and Phil doing? Oh, he told me, they asked me to want to pray. And then I just went along with it. I said, did you become a Christian? And I thought, no, I think that's probably what it was. I told you I was a bit late. But actually, anybody who's married to a man there, a wife has got a husband, you know what I mean. We are a bit slow. I mean, if you're ever in a coffee shop with your wife, she'll tell you commentary what's going on around you. There'll be people doing armed robbery and people speeding and doing all sorts of stuff. And you're going, and she'll say, do you see that there? And you go, see what?
You're just enjoying your cup of coffee. And
absolutely.
Some good company.
That's what it's about. That's what coffee is. And So I didn't get it. But see, since that day, my life, that's 10 years, I never owned a Bible. The things have happened in that time. Only God could do it, because most places, I say everywhere, I don't invite myself to. How I end up here in Belfast, how would anybody know somebody so many miles away in Omagh who I've been, God's just done amazing stuff since I gave my life to Christ. And it takes so long to tell everybody everything, but I have shared my testimony, which I never thought I would do, and nearly most churches in Northern Ireland, the south of Ireland, I've shared in America, I've shared it in England, I've been asked to do it, invited to do it, and I do it. The Church of Ireland, first of all, I told the, Barak, the minister. Actually, when I told him that I got baptized in the sea, he told me not to tell too many people. He told me to tell nobody. Yeah, he might think I'm a bit radical, you know, in the Church of Ireland. But the thing was, he gave me a warden, and when I became a warden, I started learning how the church worked, and I started getting close to people. And then the guy in the faith mission shop called Dean, he handed me a book one day. I started talking to him. He gave me a book, Fresh Wind, Fresh Fire, by Jim Cimbala, or Cimbala, the Brooklyn Tabernacle Church. And it was about prayer. And I was just pulled by prayer. A guy who didn't pray, who didn't know how to pray, I decided that our church needed to have a prayer meeting. And it's now been going 7.5 years, and it's the most amazing meeting. Like, we don't get thousands, but we get, you know, we get people who have never prayed in their whole life, and they pray out loud. And like last Tuesday night, the presence in the room, most people end up crying. Like, I would cry, and I'm like, I'm a man, I'm a firefighter, I'm not meant to cry. But, you know, that's what happens. Then I went on to be a parish reader, which means you just lead the service. We have to wear gowns, or I get teased, you have to wear the dresses. But you have to do it, and that's what they do. And then they asked me, would you be a lay reader? This is somebody 10 years ago, never read the Bible, and you end up in a lay reader, which means you can do the whole service, but most of all, you can preach. You can, and they didn't think, I mean, I got an hour and a half's lesson on preaching, and then they gave me a license. But the Bishop Ken Good wasn't, he didn't take no chances. He only gave me about 2.5 years of a license. But he did extend it about a year ago. And I have been, like this morning, I was in two churches talking about the truth. Who is the truth? The truth is the way, the truth, and the life. Last week, I was in two different churches again, and I was talking about shame, about, you know, about how that stops us from looking up and seeing Jesus. And I just share what's in my heart. And I'm just trying to tell you some of the things we've done. With three Firefighters of Christ, I have done mission throughout the world. And one of the main ones I do on my own is I lead a team. I've led a team, been out to Uganda 4 times, and just back about 4 weeks, we took a team out, and we go to fire stations, and we train them how to save lives. And they've been saving lives with this equipment. They don't have anything. They've zero, zilch, and you can't in Northern Ireland have a head that they've nothing. But we go and train them. But ultimately, we're going to share the gospel. And we share especially Jude 23, because Jude 23 says, snatch others from the fire and save them. And that's what firefighters do. So you know firefighters are special to God's heart when he writes about them in his book. And I know this book to be 100% true now. There's nothing in it that's made up. It's 100%. And actually, people ask me sometimes, you still a practicing Catholic or you become a Protestant? I never chose, none of those things were my choice. The only thing choice I made was to be a Bible-believing Christian. And that's what I stand by. But then we also spiritually, so that's physically, spiritually, we encourage firefighters to snatch them from the fire, save them. And we have done. But what we've done, firefighters have given their life to Christ in Uganda. We've also know that the training we've left them have also saved lives. I mean, put like this, you always think, how does God touch these things? And you think, I'm in Uganda. You go to Uganda now and get off a plane in Entebbe Airport. You wouldn't know where to go left, right, or straight on. It's just impossible to find. And the places I've been to, for instance, the chief of the fire station, fire service is part of the police. The police is the big overlooking body. And the fire service is a wee department of it. They keep and it's a wee department there, and they have it there so that the police officer is somebody to look up to. But they're not, actually, what they used to do, see if you misbehaved in the police service, they sent you to the fire service. But the Inspector General of the police, probably the fourth most powerful man in the whole of Uganda, in 2015, said, come to my office and meet me. And it's the grandest office, only office I've met, only place in the whole of Uganda I found that had fire detection. So you can imagine it was like well up there. But he asked to meet us. And the amount of things we get to do, and so many stories about God blessing our trips, making things happen, touching our, and we also help the children, so we're out there too. We don't raise money for ourselves, for going, we pay it all our own way, we give our own time. And actually, the first time I went to Uganda, there's a wee lad, Trevor, give me a hug, and he says, Uncle Paddy, if you come back again and bring your family, and that made me think that we could bring, and God spoke through him and said, bring your family. So my wife's been going ever since too. And the only problem with that is, people say he's come back, and she straight away goes, says, yes, we're coming back. And I go, whoa, hang on. Because logistically, it's really difficult to do those things, and I like run a mile. For instance, I don't like raising money, and every other time I've done car washes for the children's home and raised money. This time, for some reason, I didn't. I kept putting it off and putting it off till the time passed me by, and I ended up having more money to give straight to the children's home this time than before. Because God knows my weakness, and He fulfilled the need. And so those are, and day by day, I have coincidences that they're not coincidences. I help people, I serve people. One example, learning how to serve, and I don't know, I just like to share these stories. See, when you play football, and well, I don't know, maybe people are different, you play football and you get an ego, because and I got a lot of people telling me, you're a great footballer and you've done well today, and you'd go, no, I didn't, because you think you're being humble, but really what you are is you're inviting more ego, you're feeding your ego. Oh, no, you did do well. So I got this, you grow up with this thing of everything you do is for yourself, is to feed your ego. And after coming to faith in our church, and I was given different things to do, and I was leading the prayer ministry, and then coming Christmas, there was three real nice jobs to do, and I thought, I'm going to get to do these jobs. The bounty asked me, and then this Monday, as the day unfolded, I realized I wasn't asked to do any of them. I was like, hang on, they're doing zeros, they're doing nothing, and I'm doing everything, and I'm going, you're not asking me to do these things. So that was okay. I prayed about it. I searched the Bible, couldn't find it, the study Bible. I Googled it. But I knew there was something in the Bible that said, this is wrong. You shouldn't be self-serving. And I went to bed that night, woke up about, I reckon, about 4 or 5 in the morning, and very quietly, because I don't like to wake Wendy at that time of morning. I found out that's one of the secrets. And I opened this book I got in the Faith Mission Shop, and I only got it because there was £3 knocked off it. And if you come from the West, and if I haven't told you already, the West is best. And in the West, you never go into a shop without asking for a discount. You know, it's just so wrong. I mean, I even went into Topshop one day at Christmas and asked for a discount, and they couldn't believe it. And I got a discount. But anyway, what was I saying? No, I was...
serving others.
Oh, I serve, and that's it. So I opened this book, and it was in leadership, and I think it was John MacArthur wrote it in leadership. And all I ever read, and I haven't even read much more of it, was 3/4 of the first page of the introduction. And I remember waking up, opening it up, I thought, I better look this up. And I opened it, and looked at it, and there, what was it? Matthew 20, 28. The Son of Man, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, did not come to be served, but to serve the servants. And I learned that day, that night, a valuable lesson, that we're here to serve the people, yeah. And it's not about me.
And it's great, Paddy, just to hear the change from your life before Christ and going through all the religious motions to your life after Christ, where the joy is so evident and the opportunities you're grasping. Is there anything that you would love to share with us this evening, Paddy, just as we're gathered here? Any particular verse?
You know, that's a dangerous question, because I could be here a long time.
I can just cut you up. I can.
God bless me with a loud voice. And I'm very determined. And actually, I turned into, God gave me determination, but when I was playing football, I turned into the stubbornness. And playing football, I always had a wee rule, you know. And in Gaelic football, you had to have them. And that was that sometimes I had to accept that, because I played number 3. And number 3 is a full back. And I used to hate playing 3 because it was so restrictive. But you were the guardian. And it was only in later years I've realized that actually, because there's a guy who plays for the Seattle Seahawks. And he plays quarterback and he wears 3. And I read he wears 3 because he's a Christian, because it reminds him of the Trinity. So I didn't realize I had the Trinity looking after me all those years. They didn't want to do it. But at fullback, you had this thing that the ball had, sometimes you had to accept will go past you, and sometimes the man will go past you. But you never let them pass both together. There was a way. Because you know what? I realized the devil's like that too. In all them days I was walking past on my own, he never bothered with me. Jesus walking on his own, never bothered. But seeing Jesus and me together, he was making sure we weren't passing, but he didn't succeed. Especially things when I learned Ephesians 2:8-9, What an amazing thing it was. What a day it was when I read Ephesians 2:8-9 and realized that it's not by works that I have this gift of grace, that I can't boast about it. You know, I boast about it was me done it. First time I realized that, I see, the work's done. Isn't that amazing? The work's done. The cross is done. But that's not what I want to share. I want to share a wee story with you. When I was in Uganda, I was planning to do, when I come back, I was going to do a sermon on the brothers who went to meet Joseph. And he didn't recognize them. And they didn't recognize him, but he recognized them. And I wondered why, because that came into my mind. Why did they not recognize him? I mean, there's 10 of them. So how could you not recognize him? And I reckon it was shame, that they head down in shame. They couldn't have boldly approached the Egyptian, our second in command, because of shame. And I thought, not what I wanted to compare that was to people who can't come to faith like myself. I couldn't come to Christ because of shame, things I'd done wrong. So I had my head down. I wasn't looking up. And so many of us are looking down because we can't look up at the cross. Because when we think we look up at the cross, we see a finger pointing at us and telling we're wrong. Because I used to think I was being condemned all the time. But when you actually look up, you see these two arms. You say, come on ahead anytime, and give you the greatest hug going. And I thought, if only people would learn that shame, the shame is already dealt with. And I hadn't got the finish of the sermon when I went back, and I hadn't got a sermon, but the first Sunday in Uganda, in this huge church, these Ugandans, you want to see them, when you tell them God's done something great, they get up and cheer for about 20 minutes, and they start cheering, waving these hankies. And that Sunday, I said, talking about the day shame, the day Jesus died on the cross, the day shame met and fought grace, and grace won, and they all sat down and never moved. I says, you were bouncing in your chair yesterday when Ireland beat All Blacks. Come on. So anyway, that's the point it was getting to. It was their shame was holding us back. But I needed a finisher. And the pastor that day said this. He quoted Hebrews 4:16. So you think, I'm looking for a finisher. He gives it to me in Uganda. And it was 4:16. And it says, and he used the version that said boldly. He said, let us boldly approach God's throne of grace, so that we may have mercy and find grace to help us in time of need. And I thought, that's it. That's the finish. Because if you can boldly approach the throne of God, you have no shame. So last Sunday, I was doing a church, which is a wee one called Les Limna, way outside Omagh. And when I arrived, now, they told me, our rector usually finishes in 55 minutes. That's grand. But there's 6 hymns. I'm thinking, how could you do 6 hymns? And I'm going to take half an hour. But no, I wasn't going to have 15 minutes, say, right? So 20 minutes at least for the hymns, 15 minutes. That doesn't allow the room move. So she said, do you want to drop a hymn? And I thought about it. No, we'll just keep the hymns. And so I done the sermon, and I finished with, I encourage everybody to boldly approach the throne of God, God's grace, where you'll find mercy. You don't need to have any more shame. He's taken it away. And I thought that was, and I think that's a powerful statement for all of us to boldly approach the throne of God. We should not have any shame. And if I can do it, I'm a living example. If God done it, he took it away, the shame, because I used to think I'd work it. I was the, when I say, you wrote on a wee thing about isolation, I was isolated because I was shameful. If you were in somewhere, I would sort of sit at the side, because I was brought up things in my life that made me feel ashamed. I mean, failing all your O-levels is one thing you'd be shameful, because you don't tell people those sort of things. You certainly wouldn't sit in a church and tell anybody. I'd be way over there out of the way. Shame. Shame. You didn't look up. But I now boldly was able to approach the throne of God, his grace. But here's the thing. The very last hymn, and I don't even know the name of it, so couldn't have picked it. And I don't even know this lady who picked them, who played the organ. And she picked this hymn, and in verse 6, the second line, and it said, and they sang it, the last hymn, boldly approach the throne of God's grace. Now, how could you line that up from Uganda to me coming home to writing about it, going to this church, and then them thinking, oh, you can take one out? So that's what I encourage people to boldly approach. Never, ever be ashamed anymore. Shame's gone and dealt with. It's beat. It's defeated.